No, she slept with him. I told the guy she has to, he has to keep her.
Oh my God,
She,
bro.
and I was just like, true story. I was just like, we don't want to make money because then we'll be held to the valuation metrics of companies that do. As long as we don't make money, then our stock can go as, you know, as high as it wants, because there is no such thing as a valuation metric when you're not making money. AI freaks out when something that has never happened
Right,
happens.
black swan kind of thing, or something it
Yeah,
doesn't have a
or
data
eat.
set for.
Right. After 500 of these bigs, I'd call him back. I said, I bought 500 so far. And he said, did I call you? And I was like, no. I was like,
Then keep
Jesus.
buying. Did you know that the pass rate on funding challenges is less than 20%? So, what are you going to do differently in 2024 to set yourself apart from the 80% that fail? Most of you are going to need a coach. The way I can help you is through the Black Shirt Club. We have four funded full-time traders with a combined experience of over 15 years in markets, ready at your disposal to help you get funded, stay funded, and most importantly, get those payouts and keep them coming in the door. So if you're interested in the Black Shirt Club, book a free call with me down below. There's a link for you to do that. Let's hop on and see if you're a good fit. With the Black Shirt Club, you're going to get the starter pack, a year to trade Zella, private weekly coaching calls, daily live trading together, everything you need to get funded, stay funded, and get paid out. So let me help you. Book a call, use the link down below, and let's get back to the video. Traders, welcome back to the podcast. I am very honored to be sitting down with the unknown market wizard himself, Mr. Chris Cady. Chris, it's good to see you. It's good to be with you.
Well, let's get going. Here we
Let's
go.
do it.
And for everybody watching, thanks for watching. Today is March 19th.
Yes, March 19th, 2024. Time
And
flying by. And the
the
ES
S&P
just
closed.
rallied. I was going to say, just rallied
Yeah,
to close
ES just
higher.
closed
Yep.
at 5240.
Yep. So we're going to talk about a lot of things, Chris, as we were just chatting here before the recording started. And I just really can't thank you enough for giving us the time. Your experience is hard to parallel, if I could say it like that. It's hard to sit with somebody who has been trading since 1980, who has seen futures trading be born, you know?
Yeah, since the first day we had to learn what premium and discounts were. The market used to trade at a discount at times. And but for everybody watching who's just getting going, I can what we were talking about just a minute ago is that experience comes at a cost. So even now it's different than what happened years ago. And so just because someone has a lot more experience doesn't necessarily mean that they have the answers. And
Very well said.
yeah,
It's very true.
I do think we can pick and drop some things that have stood the test of time. Maybe
Absolutely.
that would help some people.
Absolutely. And you know, I think if I was a new trader, like listening to this, and I'm still relatively young and I'm still a student, as we all are,
Yes, we
you
all
are
are.
huge on the topic of adapt or die. If you do not change when the market is changing, then you will run out of this career, basically. How do you think you've made it so that, like, what is your perspective, maybe is the right question, on adaptation that you would share with the new traders on how to instill that within themselves?
I would suggest that everybody on the floor would always come by and tell you what they thought. And at a certain point, people started getting annoyed. Because remember, when I started, it was a new thing. And so eventually people got annoyed that someone would come over and say, I think this is going to go there. And so I would just pick up my phone and say, here, place the order then if you think that. And eventually we all got to the point where we just said it's a prediction-free zone. And then even people said things like every trade a story, as though it was some every single trade that you made was worthy of being over, you know, retold over a beer at the end of the day. So for a new person watching, the idea being that the need to predict, which is really fun, right? If you're gonna, in a sense, and you're trying to predict a move and say, for example, today you were like, this is way overbought and it's the prices are high and I think prices are gonna go down. That's super fun. It gives you a kind of an adrenaline buzz to actually think that you can reflect your opinion by clicking the mouse and be right. Is a validation of your process of who you are, the fact even that you're existing. And I do think that for the new traders watching that, I do think you need to change that perspective to one that where you're reacting to what's happening. What does it say here? It says trade. I have it on my note here on my back of an order ticket. It says trade what you see, not what you think. And what does the market want to do? And so for a new trader, I do think that I mean, it sounds almost like factory work, right? Monkey see, monkey do, right? You wait and you let the market tell you what it wants to do, and then you just act in accordance. You're dancing with the person that brought you, the market brought you here, so you have to dance with the market. So for the people watching, I would suggest that you really learn to put your predictive tendencies on hold, or maybe paper trade with your predictive tendencies, and then just let the market try and let the market tell you how to trade,
I love that because
or at least tell you not what not to do.
exactly. That's what I was going to say. And I think it is the sexy side of trading to call the top. Shout out to
Right.
Lucci, right? Like,
Right.
are we exposing everybody to what Lucci was trying to do today? He's throwing shorts in and the market just keeps rallying higher. But
I mean,
he might have. Knowing
you
Lucci,
know,
he might have. But
and
it is the sexy thing, but it is not always the profitable thing. I'm not sure. Do you know Anthony Crudele? Have you met Crudele
yeah,
before?
I haven't met him, but we've exchanged a couple
Strange.
notes back and forth.
He's a great guy. And I asked him on the podcast. We were doing some like strategy talk, and we were talking about his favorite trade and his most profitable trade. And his favorite trade was not his most profitable trade. The favorite trade is often the short from the top when you nail the top, but that always isn't the money-making trade. Would you agree with that?
1,000,000%. It's think about it this way. What is the market offering people? It's offering people the ability to go against the consensus, right? Did you fight with your mother when you were growing up, right? It offers those people an avenue to exercise that need. It offers people the need to say, I think. Right. Every time you hit the mouse is an I think moment. It offers people to participate with the herd. Right. If you are one of those people who like to go along with everything, right? So the markets out there, it offers the opportunity to sell into a spike of, say, a short run, a short stop covering run higher. You can sell into that where you're like, oh, this is that window of opportunity where everybody's puking and I need to get involved because there's no one behind the run up. But once those orders are filled, it's a vacuum right back down. So if you think about the way that the market's functioning, it's that the price is offering in the context of there's like all these stories that will in a sense catch the person who's unaware of a subconscious or unconscious tendency the sort of unstoppable need to participate in that juncture. And maybe if you can see that the market is trying to get people involved from an emotional perspective and a story perspective, and this, you know, what's the story like if Lucci was selling them all day today, I don't know. And the market kept going higher. That's what's that story? Well, prices are too high, right? But if we take a look at that, just even let's take a look at the pricing. Price is too high. What's the function of price? Price is there to facilitate a transaction. Okay, so there's no such thing as too high or too low because all price is empty of meaning. It's just there to facilitate a transaction. So back to the point of, you know, think about what the market is offering you from a, or what it's offering everybody, or what you can see. It's that people, for whatever reason, no matter the price, they need to buy them. You have to respect what the herd wants to do, and you have to respect the story that's being told. And if you act without any sort of understanding of that context, you're acting on your biases or your best shot. So you better make sure that you have a stop because, generally speaking, the herd has been correct here on the upside. Well, I'm sorry, I kind of lost the
No,
question.
I was just letting you go. It was good. That was very well said. And I think that especially right now with market conditions how they are, it is reinforcing the idea of potentially making more money with the herd than trying to be sexy and fight the herd. So throughout your career, have you found that
with the herd has made you more money, or have you made more money fighting the herd?
The consensus in the internet explosion from 98 to 2000 was like pegged record bullish the whole way up, and they were right.
Right.
And then of course, when you start to, you know, the bulls, bears, right? All those sentiment indicators. So just like anything, right? Nothing's perfect. So we've seen it be right. Everybody, of course, is looking for an answer. I don't have the answer here in regards to sentiment, other than prior to the 98, 99, 99, 2000, both years the NASDAQ doubled year over year.
That's crazy.
I know, isn't that nuts?
It is.
Pets.com was worth more than General Motors. And then
that's insane.
There were people on CNBC who were going public. And on CNBC, which was broadcast on the floor, it was like the best soap opera in the day. Everybody was like, and the guy's like, well, we don't want to make money. True. It's a true story. We don't want to make money because then we'll be held to the valuation metrics of companies that do. As long as we don't make money, then our stock can go as high as it wants, because there is no such thing as a valuation metric when you're not making money. And
how do you play that as a trader? Do you short this because this guy is crazy, or do you ride this up as high as this is going to go? That is such a weird thing to say in front of all of the traders on the pit on CNBC.
He was standing on the floor of New York Stock Exchange talking to Maria when he said
that. So he's
that.
Right there.
That's, he was there, yeah, insane. For his IPO. That's a 60, you know, you see this in all the research papers, right? Where they're like, mm-hmm. we're in a bubble or things are expensive. Mm-hmm. And they have those fear greed meters and they have the sentiment indicators. From a trading perspective, long, 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 long time ago, because the only metric we had was technical analysis, we could occasionally get some sort of macro thing, but I remember three professors that used to come down from NYU every summer and trade in the bottom of the ring. And then 10 o'clock number would come out and they'd all confer in the bottom of the ring. And then they'd start doing something. They'd be selling into the rally. And then by the end of the day, they had lost all their money. And so I started to recognize that maybe the macro fundamental viewpoint isn't going to work as well as it's supposed to. And then what did that leave us? That left us technical analysis. Well, I mean, okay, certain aspects of technical analysis, right? Where are the stops above the trend lines? Okay, so market's going to go get the stops. The market doesn't care about a trend line. It cares about the stops. It wants to go get those, get the paper. So then you start to learn, you know, certain technical indicators are a place where stops are located, or above or below, and we're going to go there. And then so all of a sudden, it's like you start to recognize that technical analysis has its limitations. A screwdriver is only a screwdriver, and a pair of pliers is a pair of pliers, and you use them for different jobs and different times. And the same thing with technical analysis. It is still moving averages are still widely used. So. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, you know, every day for the last 40 years, practically every day is a record high. So you're like, okay, well, what? Now we don't have any reference points. And so it finally dawned on me, like, I say this all the time, and it's what I used to say in the 80s, I think, or even in the 90s. You get into a spaceship, you fly to the end of the universe, you get out of the spaceship, what's there? And essentially, that's where we are in the markets, right? You're at prices never traded before. And so you have no reference points up here.
I hope you're enjoying today's video. Just want to give a shout out to the sponsor, Top One Trader. If you're looking to get funded, I've got a link and a discount code for you down below that's going to save you big bucks on your next funding challenge. So thank you to Top One. Now let's get back to the video.
And so to answer your question is, you know, what do we, you know, how do we tell we're in a bubble and where does it stop? I don't know. I can tell you that I have seen both a blow off top in 2000, in April, I think it was, of 2000, where the Dow went up like 600 points in 3 days, and that was the top. In 87, that kind of just rolled, it made a secondary high and then rolled over and picked up speed on the way down.
So they all look kind of different.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, we've seen massive moves. We've seen just the buying peter out at the highs. It's like a lack of interest in buying. The last stuff that I'd gotten from Pete and Steve Hawkins, Pete Suttlemeyer, Creator Market Profile, was that their volume studies have shown that tops are a function of a lack of buying, not some giant Godzilla force meeting King Kong.
I think that
And
makes sense.
right, it's like a disinterest almost,
It's a
right? Like,
disinterest because the interest, like you said, every day, basically in your entire career, minus the couple of bear markets, we've made new highs. So the interest is always for inflow of capital from all over the world, not just domestically, but all over to flow into American markets, into US equities and things like that. So if the inflow is to send us higher, it does make sense that the only thing that would slow it down and then potentially create that top would be lack of interest. Like I
right.
think that that is logical. Yeah.
I mean, for years they had said, right, that higher prices shut off buying. In other words, it costs a dollar to buy one share of stock at a dollar. And if the stock goes to $10, it takes 10 times the money, right? It takes $10 to buy right? So the idea of that higher prices ration the buying seem to have fallen by the wayside in the shall we say, in the era of endless free money that we've had.
The QE.
Or the deficit spending too. Victor, I remember Victor, when I first started working for him in 1985, commissioned a study where he tracked deficits. Everything was on pen and pencil and paper, where they tracked deficits, and with like a 3 month or 6 month lag, I forget what it was, the stock market responded in kind to the deficits. And Victor was like, hey, check this out. Because at the time, people were so concerned that deficits were going to be a problem for the dollar or the markets or something. And Victor was like, here, look, I wanted to, he showed me this study. It said that deficits obviously find their way, the money printed finds its way into the economy, and that money then finds its way into the corporations is bullish for stocks. And so we obviously have moved beyond the narrative of deficits are a problem to now where they're just endlessly, and we're
Yeah, now
Janet.
it's like don't even spell deficit. We don't,
Right.
that word is not in the dictionary anymore.
Right. It's not even party sensitive. It's just everybody spends. And I mean, I remember Janet saying, spend like it's 2023 or something like that. And so,
Party like it's 1999.
right, exactly, right? Like you guys are pikers. You need to really print money. And
So if
anyhow.
for someone like yourself then, Chris, before I do want to get into some of my other questions that
Sure.
are, I think, specifics for the traders, you've worked for the firms that are, got guys on the in the pit. Is when you mentioned the you said in the pit and then you said in the ring. Is the ring and the pit the same thing, just for the
Same
listeners?
thing, same
Okay,
thing.
that's what I thought. So as someone who has seen markets expand and you've seen technology make markets more accessible to other traders, has it killed every ounce of bear in you? Like overall, how can you be a bear when you've seen the markets are so resilient? They always have come back. They've always pushed to new highs. Add technology, make it more accessible, add more participants. It doesn't matter. It doesn't slow down the market. So are you able to still today when you're trading, is it easy for you to short the market?
No,
No.
no. Being so, but think about this, right? For 25 years, I stood in the ring. I'm trying to think when it went mostly electronic. For 25 years, at least, maybe 30, I stood in the ring, and most every order was a buy order. So if you're in the ring and you want to trade with the edge, right, and which is that's what we're all looking for is an edge. You had to lead from the short side.
Makes
You
sense.
had to, right, because a broker was you were like, this guy's paying too much, and then the next guy would, and you'd look and that guy's paying too much, and then finally at a certain point you were just like, all right, this is insane. These people are just they're relentlessly buying. Someone here is paying too much, and then you'd sell them, and you take them back for two, three ticks. Something of that nature, and that was how you could pay the rent. Now, given the markets now today, there are very few, like the vertical moves have very few pullbacks in them, so that the nature of the scalper has changed. Because
Yeah.
the I think, but why has that changed, right? Well, when we were in the ring, the people in the ring had more money than the orders. So that was a distribution that would generally distribute horizontally. In other words, you'd spend very little time at the high, very little time at the low, and it would spend the most of the time in between those two. That was what you have the normal bell curve profile, and that was the distribution. When the orders, when the outside money, the institution started having more money than the ring, the brokers would come in and say, well, what's here? And we started to find out really quickly that they had more order than we could fill in the ring, their size, you know, they had Goldman, whoever,
massive,
right? So we would just say, you tell us, you know, we're not getting it. It's like, do you want to step in front of the freight train? No, I do not want to step in front of the freight train.
This is the steamroll people. Right.
And so now you see that accordingly, because the ease of access, in other words, we all have the mouse, we see the DOM, because of the ease of access to the market, there's the illusion of liquidity. But there's not a collective group of people such as there were in the ring to actually try and contain the orders. So now we have vertical distributions, right? There's no resting anything.
Right.
So
it's tough to be a short. That's what it is.
Not only is it tough to be a short, but on a down day, it's pretty hard to be a long. In other words,
exactly.
They will run further, faster without any retracements. So if you're watching and you're just learning how to trade, make sure that you have a stop for years, for decades. If you sold them in the right place, you would get a second or two or three or even another chance to get out if you were wrong.
Yeah.
But now that doesn't exist right now.
I was going to say that does not exist. Exactly.
Right. You need to.
So scalping has changed a lot. Were you scalping originally on the floor for just a couple of ticks like you mentioned?
Yeah. I mean, think about, you know, what did you have at your disposal in the ring? You just had
your hands, your voice.
Right. But I mean, from a diagnostic perspective of
very
where
little.
You were, you maybe someone on the bottom of the ring had a point and figure chart that you could ask to take a look at.
Right.
Right. And so the only knowledge you had was that
price,
you know, price. And then the particular amount of, you knew Goldman was a seller over there and someone behind you, retail, is buying. And so the guy would just tap you on the back and say, buy three lots or whatever. You'd be like, sold. And you get the same price as the guy offering across the ring for Goldman, who didn't want to sell three lots across the pit. He wanted to sell 50 or 100. And so, and then you would just bid two ticks lower for three lots, and, you know, some other retail paper would
pick
come
it
in
up
and sell,
would
right, and hit you. And so that's how you learned and paid the rent. And then, but that's no longer available. And that's why I think the seats were so expensive, right? Is that there was an associated edge to the order flow, being that all business was transacted in one central location.
And how much were the seats originally?
Not a lot.
I was going to say, when they first opened the pit, it probably wasn't that way. But then once the big money comes in, that's when it gets more expensive.
Yeah, like the NYMEX seats, which sold for millions when they went public, were 30,000, 40,000.
Really? That's crazy. Yeah. Okay, so before we get off of this, you mentioned to me already you knew someone who was throwing large size. So who's the biggest, or what is the biggest size you've ever seen thrown in the pit or even on the retail side that you're kind of on now?
I mean, a lot of size players have had complex positions, whether they were, in the case of in the sugar ring, there was a guy from Brazil who had thousands of futures and tens of thousands of options associated with that. And it was, I assume, part of his business of the being in the sugar business. When the exchange shut him down, that was thousands. I had a client who sold wing puts for 5 years, and every month he would sell 20,000 of them.
Wow.
These were big ones, so that'd be 200,000 minis.
200,000 minis in what year?
In 2008, he was short.
Oh my gosh.
He was short 200,000 puts that were quickly approaching in the money. And so that was a, I saw that unwind. That was a big position.
Huge.
From my own perspective, it wasn't uncommon on it. You would trade on an edge, right? And you would get the edge. It wasn't uncommon to trade 20 of that would be 200 of the minis, but and certainly my friends, it wasn't, it was common to trade 100 lot of bigs, which was,
1,000 minis.
yes,
Wow.
it was, but that was common, that was commonplace. And as the also, since you're trading predominantly that kind of size, you needed an edge. It also depended on the order flow,
Sure.
right? When there was volatility and a lot of people were involved, you could flip 100 lots around. I remember in 87, one of my stepbrothers, who was, it was Jones and Soros was selling 200s and Jones was buying 210s. That's 10 handles apart in the S&P pit. And the guys were buying 100 lot and one side of the ring, walking across the ring and selling the 100 lot to the other guy. And it was like $500,000 or something like that.
Jeez.
And
And
people were coming out of the ring crying with tears in their eyes that they just made that kind of money.
in 1987.
Yeah. And
So
so,
inflation adjusted, those people could basically buy Canada at this point if they were trading that kind of
right?
size.
I mean, you didn't necessarily, if you were a big trader, you didn't necessarily want to show size. In
I
fact,
was going to say you didn't want to show the cards, right?
a lot of guys, I mean, there were guys in my pit who would be short hundreds of futures on every day. And so, yeah, size was,
Size was large back in the day. It still is, right? I mean,
yeah,
even
I mean, but
for what you're doing now.
size was not necessarily a metric of,
Success.
yeah, it was more along the lines of when you chose to use it, or how much you could work out of a trade,
And that
how
would be
much
the
you
interesting thing, right? Because then you would say, okay, why is this guy coming in with size today when he never comes in with this kind of size? What information does he have? What's going on? Right. Right. And that would make everybody's head. He'd be
For
walking
sure.
across the pit after placing the order, and you're looking at him scratching his head. Did he really do that just now? Like, what did I miss? And that would
Yeah.
create, I'm sure, a frenzy. And if that's just the psychology of markets in a sense, right there, right?
Mark Fisher was great at the, he had a clearing firm called MBF, and he came from the sugar pit, which was a big pit. It still is,
Really?
or yeah, big pit, huge, huge volume. It was 11.25 a tick, or 6.25. I forget
Oh,
what. I think it was
wow.
6.25. So, but he say the market was 10 bid at 11 cents. Yeah, I mean 10. It'd be like currently it's like 21 cents. So it'd be like 21.10 bid at 21.11, and he would just come in and go 20 bid up, 9 cents above the offer, and take everything. But it did manage to change the psychology.
Of course.
And so there was, that was an interesting strategy. Not many people did that, and he managed to do that quite
Take some
successfully.
balls to do that. Let's not kid ourselves there.
Yeah, I'd see, I saw it work both ways for him. I
Oh,
saw it work.
I bet that doesn't always end up in your favor, for sure.
Yeah, but anyway, perhaps we can help people. The idea is that if you are unsure about of a trade, I would suggest that you start small and then don't average, and then as you become more confident, add slowly. Be very careful in adding to trades. It's one, and you're generally speaking, your first entry should be your best.
I
If you're
agree.
right, if you
Yeah.
have that first entry and you're wrong, maybe, you can't be perfect, right? But you better be right quick,
Yeah.
right? And so, and then there's always a caveat, right? If you get your price, you may not want your price. Right, if you have a spot on the chart, you're like, oh, this is the perfect place to sell them, and it's obvious everybody else sees it, then you either have to sell them before they get to the price, or assume
Right.
they're going to run the stops above that price and then sell them and then get them back if it trade, it should trade back down through
Of
you.
course.
But it's very rare, given in the age of artificial intelligence, that you'll get a clean chart entry. You have to assume that any thing you see on your screen, AI is seeing this.
Yeah, that's a great, great little tidbit for the new guys too.
You
mentioned AI there. Do you think that the retail trader who is trading from home with AI, and not just AI in general, but the big institutions and the banks, and I mean, everybody is using AI probably more than the guy at home. Is there still an edge to be had for the trader at home with all of this competition?
To be determined. I hope so.
I hope I so think, too.
Right. I mean, you can see the character of the market has changed because of AI, right? It's the market used to have a sort of a living, breathing element to it for the ebbs and flows. And now it's purely a machine. And so that just tells you that there's a lot of money P&L to AI. And having worked with it for a while, it's smarter than I am. And that's a hard pill to swallow. And so for the person playing at home, the place where I think we do have, and I've said it recently, I said, I discovered it just because I was like, well, if what's the purpose of the market? The purpose of the market, generally speaking, years at 30, 40 years ago, they were like the formation of capital and the transfer of risk. Okay, well, it's not that. It's now a vehicle to provide a narrative and a return for, and so, okay, so what does AI see? AI sees everything. It's like this, your partner who has a transcript of everything you've ever done and knows you better
right.
than,
right.
right? So it knows everything. So where are the two places that humans excel? One is that they adapt faster than AI. AI can only see what's happened. It can't function it when there's a situation where something's happening that's never happened. So given that, I'd suggest that we're going to see, you have to, in a probability sort of skew, you need to weight the probability of something that's never happened and happened happening more frequently, because that's the only way humans will beat AI. And then the second one is from an intraday basis, just scalping around. If you get to a spot where you are close to where you want to put on a trade, but there's no exact reference point right there, I think that's where we execute. I think executing into a place with no reference points means that the AI, most AI doesn't have, because if you see the reference point, AI has already figured out what the odds of that reference point are working.
Right.
And then.
So you almost want to operate, you're saying, in the gray, because the AI can't operate in the gray.
Right.
That's an interesting take.
Right. Because AI can't operate in the gray.
Because it can't
AI
operate that. It needs the reference point. Interesting. Yep. Okay.
And,
that's very
and,
interesting.
Right. Remember that it AI freaks out when something that has never happened happens.
Right. Black swan kind of thing, or something it doesn't have a data set for.
Right. It just is like, it starts making these wild predictions in the ensuing next sequences, because the more recent data, the most recent thing is weighted heavily versus the stuff that's happened 30 years ago.
Sure.
Right. I mean, in other words, it makes perfect sense, right? You observe what is happening, assume it will continue.
Sure.
And so AI is weighted to that sort of rule. And so when something happens that freaks it out, AI becomes worthless. And that, right. But
that's an edge, you know, potentially for us.
Yes, for sure. Like, we adapt faster.
We adapt faster. And it's interesting that you bring that up. It makes me think about, I saw a chart recently that shows the periods of time we've gone with the ES, or with, we could just call it the market, where we don't make new all-time highs. But like you mentioned earlier, since we've entered the QE era, we just have this period of time where we basically are always making new all-time highs. So in that previous period where we weren't always moving higher, you maybe could even find more gray. Whereas like now, like we've been kind of saying in this conversation already, it's really hard. You almost need a huge catalyst to create the short momentum to then go in and find the opportunities to exploit that, because the market is naturally just right now with the QE and the drift and the AI, it's going to go higher, isn't it?
Well, remember, we're not making predictions.
No predictions.
Right. But you, with the amount of money that's coming into the system, with the definitely political bend to the financial elite, I would suggest that, in the fact that political decisions move prices. Thank you, Victor. I mean, as much of an answer is that the bias is up, the market goes up what is it, goes up 4 out of 7 days or something like that.
55% of the time, something like that, they say.
Yeah, something like that. And then I would think that any down move is going to be like to the Stone Age. So if I'm not kidding, it's like everybody's so all in, right? The Japanese, the Europeans, we're all so in. There's so much leverage in the system that there's not even enough cash in circulation to make a 20% margin call. So that's why the VIX is nailed to 13.
Right.
Right. And so because everybody's so all in, that just lowers it's so binary that it's just like,
I know what you're saying.
That the potential, like my friend Paul is like, there can't ever be a crash because he's like, I don't think there's going to be a crash because there can't be a crash.
Right. That's what I've heard a lot of people say. And it's almost like the whole Enron thing, too big to fail. Is the market now just too big to fail? And you can argue this till the cows come home, really. I mean, the arguments on both sides are very valid, but it's tough to see. You need a catalyst. Something needs to happen for the market to really slide. What do they say? It takes the escalator down. An asteroid. Right, exactly. Right, like Los asteroid. Angeles gets wiped out and now exactly. Stock market's closed. Then maybe when the asteroid hits LA, we drop 4% maybe that day. Maybe 4%.
And then people buy the dip.
Right, exactly. We're back up 8% with all Los Angeles gone.
Right. Because why? Because they're going to print more.
They're going to print more money, right? So it's so interesting. Okay, so this has been good, Chris. I want to pivot for a second if we can, just because I want to honor your time. Yeah, and I want to hit a couple other things. How do you define consistent trading?
I'll use Stottlemyre's definition: slow, steady, positive cash flow.
Slow, steady, positive cash flow. Do you think that's attainable in today's market as a scalper?
Yes.
Why do you think people are so hateful on scalpers? So many people that I see on the internet say you can't make a living as a scalper. And I've only seen successful trading for my own personal P&L as a scalper. I've never been able to make consistent returns in any other way yet.
Well, certainly there's going to be there's many people who are very wealthy who've never sold anything.
True.
Right. And so you can, obviously those people are demonstrating.
But I bucket them with the investors. I don't bucket them with us as traders.
As traders, for sure. There are no question, it's easier to predict the next 5 minutes than the next 5 hours. So from that short duration perspective,
it's a great
you're
point.
Limiting, right? You're limiting your risk. So I would suggest that the high frequency people are also making a lot of money scalping.
Right.
So
so it's probably the people's insecurities of them thinking they can't scalp of why they talk so much shit about it.
All right. Well, here, let's help people if they want to scalp. Well,
yes.
Okay. So 85% of the time, the market reverts. Okay. So you need to set up some sort of thing that creates a mean. That would be a moving average or a weighted VWAP to the beginning.
I was going to say, VWAP to the start of the day. That's what I use.
Right, right. Okay. And then you use some sort of percentage bands, whether they're
standard deviation, whatever it may be.
Bollinger's, whatever, pegged to that thing that appears to be the weighted average or the mean for the day. And then 15% of the time, the market trades vertically and does not revert. Now, on those 15% of the time days, you do not want to use a reversion to the mean strategy, right? So your first diagnosis of this setup for the day would be, oh, is this the day that is just chopping back and forth and reverts all day?
Or are we blowing out of here?
Right. Are we on the asteroid? Are we going somewhere?
Correct. Right.
And
that's a tough question to answer. If you could elaborate on that a little bit, I think people would appreciate that. Like, how do you know the difference? Because I trade ES like you do. Some days it's like, I want to know that we're going to blow off. Okay, is it as simple as saying when we take out the daily VWAP, buyers have taken control, get out of the way? I don't know if it's that simple.
If a market's balanced, so how do we know what a balanced market is? That's where the moving averages of different time frames. I use 65 and 33 on a 30-minute chart. When those lines go flat, you have the condition that we would call balanced. There's many ways to measure balance. It would look like an ice cream cone on its side,
sure,
right?
Sure, like where the lines are coming together. Yep,
yeah,
just a pennant. Yep.
Right. It would look like a pennant. That would be balance. Okay, so
equilibrium.
Fair price, as
fair
you say.
Price. Yeah.
And so for whatever reason, whatever the price may be, it's where all the participants are have what they need and we all agree that it's a fair price. So if you get a vertical move from there, the generally speaking, there's a person with a big order that's looking to upset the balance, or is going to upset the balance. Okay. So people that will then get on board, and the process is that when a market's leaving a balanced position, when the market's leaving a balanced position, there should be zero retracement because everybody is already, the market's balanced. Everybody has what it needs. So what's causing it to move is a big order. That big order is nobody knows how big it is, except the only person who knows is the person who's executing it.
Sure.
But everybody else is going to be like, okay, I'm getting on board. And so the criteria for getting on board of a vertical move, such as what we're talking about, would be that it's leaving a balanced position and it starts to go vertical. And then it needs to be going, say we're going up. And so if the market's balanced here at 52.40, and then you think that it's going higher because it's starting to tick up in a straight line pretty quickly, you buy the 52.44s, and then in 30 seconds, it better be 45.
Sure.
Because, right, there should be, because
no
when
lag,
leaving,
it should not start pulling back. It should
start
going.
There should be zero retracements if it's the right. beginning. There will be zero retracements. It's actually
if you're
the safest.
Trading out of that balance position, is what you're saying.
Right,
you have to
right.
trade out of the balance position. If you're overextended now is when you look for the mean reversion stuff.
Yes.
That makes sense.
You could teach
I
it.
Told you I was going to study you, Chris,
right.
before we had the podcast. I
you
said I'm going to understand this. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? So, there,
that
so
makes
where's
sense
the
because
art?
You want the launch pad almost, right? The,
right.
The balance is the launch pad for
yes.
that next move up.
Yes. And Stottlemyre would always say the market's looking to close off a direction. So sometimes it will go one way from balance, like three or four handles, and then revert and go the other way, like 25 handles.
Mm.
So you make sure that if you execute, if you're buying them, that if you're wrong, you get out within 5 seconds, 10 seconds. You can't, from a balanced position, there is no averaging positions there. You've got to go if you're wrong.
Especially not averaging into it if it's losing. I have a lot
right,
of guys
that's
that
what
are
I'm saying.
Adding to losing trades. And I know you
from
hate
a balance,
that.
Yeah, but from a balanced position, if you're adding to a losing trade, you're just, that's that you're ending your career.
Yeah.
Right there. And so the understanding is that, so it's something that happens very quickly and you're like, fuck, you know, I just got stopped out. But if you just wait a minute, you know, it's basically, if it's in a balanced position, it's going to try and chop around a little bit to get someone to tip their hand.
Sure.
But when it goes, it goes. And then, as you say, right, after, you know, if it goes 50 handles, then you're like, okay, is this enough? Right. You don't, at a certain point, you, because you get more and more people involved and said,
right now everyone's
out
piling
more.
In. Yep.
Right. You get, then as time goes by, and this is what happens when you're writing a trend following system, is that you need to build in tolerances as the move extends itself, because, you know, what's a proper retracement? And that's when you start to use the reversion to the mean.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's the art. It's like, where do you step in and start trading reversion to the mean? Because everybody's buying those dips at the tail end of a breakout. And then it's, the market's not going anywhere.
Right.
Right. The buyer's
super common.
Done.
Yep.
Super common.
Very common. Do you find that in this framework of thinking, you get more of these trend following trades where you catch that initial move and you can ride that type of momentum? Or do you find, like, today you're trading more of the mean reversion stuff? Because I'm just trying to give the audience a frame of reference. How much does this happen in both buckets? You know what I mean? Is it 50-50? Because I don't think so, right? You don't find balance 50% of the time.
It's reverting 85% of the time.
There you go. Got it.
Okay. And so it's only, so that's.
And that's
so,
exactly how it feels. Sorry to cut you off. It feels like I get those blow off days where you're, some days you're long, you make a little money. Some days you'd miss the long and you're like, how did I miss this? I feel like that's about 15% of the time. And then the other days where I'm trading within levels or we're not at that point, I can totally make my money, make my little nut, happy days, walk off and enjoy the day. You know what I'm
right.
saying?
Right. And so what I think is important is that if you're budgeting money for a breakout trade, understand that it's only a 15% time, but also understand that it's going to go way further than you think. So,
Great
yeah,
point.
just being aware of the 85% of the time you're reverting. So
That's
that a
it.
lot of times people get lazy and they never even, they're always using reversion every day, but just, you know, just be aware of the 15% of the time.
Where
It's
it will
really
smoke your
hard,
reversion stat.
right?
And you will think, is it like you're when you said a minute ago, you're like, is it done? I've had the thought, it's 2:50. You still got a little bit of time left. Is it done? Maybe it's not. Just kidding. Power hour, last hour of the day. Boom, boom, boom. Like we saw it today, last 10 or 15 minutes, it rallied for a new high of day.
Right, isn't that, and that's a great time. Great point is to watch the clock. Like if they start too early, you know, do they have the gas to go all day? It's very rare, right? But yet,
Very
as you
rare.
say, right, like the last half hour, and they start to come for them after coming hard all day. You know, it's a mark job, or someone's trying to make themselves right, or and you know, tomorrow's a Fed meeting, and so there's always been the pre-Fed drift.
Of course. And then Powell come in and shake it all up. So when your day's on the floor, what would you guys do on Fed week like this? Would you guys be trading a lot? Would you guys be playing cards? What would you guys be doing?
No, we would trade, but we
Cut size.
cut size and scalp. And then the older guys, or everyone was older than me, was would say never trade when the Fed's in the market. Never,
I've heard that
never
many
trade.
times.
And then they would also say never initiate a position from the road, only exit, like if you're going on vacation or something like that. And never, never trade
Hey,
on
that's still a good
vacation.
advice. You know how many times I have to tell people, Chris, stop trading from your phone. I'm like, why do you think you're going to do well when you're competing against guys like you and these kids want to trade from their phone and do well? It's like, it's just crazy to me. So same kind of context there.
You know, the young, I can't speak, you know, we can wish them well, but
Yes.
you know, like my friend Paul's been long a boatload of silver. Had he bought Bitcoin, he would have done much better.
Of course.
So, I mean, the younger generation is taking the reins, and they will make the rules, and
Markets will change.
right. And
Industries
if
will
they're going to
shift.
trade from their phones, I'm just telling you what they told me, right? Just only exit trades on the road, never initiate,
Never
and never
initiate.
trade, right? And never trade. I mean, we will always trade when the Fed's around, but just be
Of course,
aware
but when
that,
the Fed's in the market like tomorrow, it's a good day to be flat. Okay, Chris, I
right.
know we had an hour and we went a little over. Can I get 10 more minutes out of you? Do you
Yeah,
mind?
sure. Yeah.
Cool. All right, so let me hit you with a few other things. I know you mentioned you had a story for us that you haven't told anybody. Before we get off the pits fully, can you share that story?
Oh yeah. In the right after 2000, after 9/11, I got invited to join a high level meditation group of U.S. people, U.S. citizens, at the invitation of the Tibetan monasteries, specifically the Dalai Lama and Dharamsala, and they chose 42 people to get the second 20-year course of study in the monasteries, and it was free, and I didn't know, I had a yoga instructor girlfriend, which is why I was chosen, I think, and perhaps I was the only one from Wall Street at the time, but which involved many, many hours of coursework, quizzes, tests, lectures from both Tibetans and Americans, month-long silent retreats, 2 week for years. And but in my travels, I met another monk who came up to me, and he said, you know, I'm so and so, and I hear you work on Wall Street. And I said, yes, I'm on the floor of the exchange. And he said, I was the programmer for long-term capital,
No.
man. And I was like, no way. And he's like, yeah, way. He was an American kid then,
And now
and
turned monk.
he became a monk. And I
Wow.
was like, what happened? And he goes, I wrote the program for that, and I wrote it for 2x leverage. And I go, well, where did they ramp it up to? He said, first they
200.
were, no, they only ramped it up to like 8x,
Oh, only 8.
only 8x leverage. And then he said, and he couldn't stop them. they were like, but it works at 2 times leverage, so great. Why can't we just lever it up? It'll work even better.
Of course. Greed never sleeps.
Right? Never sleeps. And oh, I wish I remember his name. He had dark hair. And he had shaved his head and was wearing the red robes.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having long conversations with him about how he had tried to fight them from levering it up to 10 times and that there was nothing he could do. And then when it all blew up, he was like, this whole system is so screwed. And for the people who were watching, it was the first time the Fed had ever bailed out a hedge fund. And at the time they were threatening to take down the entire financial system. It was basically an arb between developing market debt and our markets. And I guess, the typical black swan event, one of the legs of the arb moved and they couldn't come up with the collateral. So the Fed stepped in but that's a story that I've never told.
What did it teach you when you had that did it influence you when you went back to Wall Street?
Yeah, I was like,
you were like, damn, should I shave my head?
No. I had also read Taleb's Fooled by Randomness.
Great book.
Right before 2008. And I covered all my short puts. And my friends in the ring were like, what are you doing? And I was like, I just read Fooled by Randomness and I don't like my position. That was a great book. I learned a lot there. There are many stories of, like, we're talking about the airport trade. Someone was chimed in on the chat today about so many times guys in the ring would just put on a huge position and go to the airport and wait till the close or very close to the close. And if the position was in their favor, they'd have a clerk buy them back and they'd come back from the airport. And if not,
they would get on a plane and leave the country.
To a country without extradition, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And that was called the airport trades. And I've seen it.
That's crazy.
I've seen it in the crude. I've seen it in the gold. I've seen it in the stock indexes.
Just full margin me and I'm buying a ticket to Colombia or something.
No, you have to understand that our relationships with the clearing firms, we didn't have any margin supervision.
So you could just run it up.
You could literally put 1,000 lots on. There was no one
to stop you. There was no account balance that you had to have in an account to put the position on.
No, right.
Oh my God.
It was right. It was literally a pen on paper. And
That's
then you
insane.
Submitted, you the cards got key punched once by noon and then once by the end of the day. So if the, and you generally, if you were a small trader and you'd put on a huge position, it wouldn't have been known because they weren't looking for you.
Sure.
And there was one person in our case, Bernadette, who worked for Spear Leads. She would go around looking for the people with the huge positions and be,
oh,
like,
of course.
Right. And so that was called airport trades.
That's insane. It's almost unfathomable to a guy like me that's always been, a retail trader where you had margin and you would get
right.
Below, yeah, no,
it's
that's
like you
that's
get the reject, like for whatever reason, I put way too much size, like fat finger, right?
Right. You fat finger and it rejects your order. I know
order,
what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like I was typing something and I just clicked onto the DOM and then it just is like, no, you can't do 5,000 spoos. And But yes, many, 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 many funny stories. Like we were having a tough time one year. I think it was 94. And for Halloween, people were, we were always saying, would you like fries with that? Because that was going to be our next job working at McDonald's. And so someone would come in wearing, like on Halloween, would come in literally as Ronald McDonald and put his badge on in the ring.
That's funny.
In 87, someone hired, this was it like Wednesday after the crash, we had a visitors gallery and someone hired strippers, and
of course
they
no Wall Street story is complete without strippers.
True story. They hired strippers in the visitors gallery doing a strip show in the middle of the market crash.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
I really liked, Chris, I don't mean to cut you off on the stories. I really liked what you said, though, in one of the interviews I watched about you, where you said, I forget, Wall Street is the where it's NASA and it was with those
Vegas.
kids. NASA and Vegas come together. I was like,
Yeah.
that is exactly why I like it.
It
Like, it's
is.
just,
Yeah.
it is
People
it.
used to
There it
come
is.
on the floor and just be like, you guys are all just a bunch of misfits.
Yep.
I just like, I mean, that's the only thing I ever did. So I didn't really know what else there
You've
was out
embraced it
there.
at this point. You are the king
Yeah.
misfit at this point, right? One of
And
them.
so the, certainly futures were they were on the bottom back page of the Wall Street Journal. It was just like this, sort of black sheep. It was Wall Street was always like buttoned down and so preppy
Right. Now
and
this was the breakout where you could be
right, like these
the
guys.
degenerate. This is where the word degenerate comes from a little bit.
Right, it was like Brooklyn, Staten Island, Irish, Italian, Jersey, Long
Oh yeah.
Island,
Oh yeah.
right? And it or in Chicago, right? It was all the same sort of thing in Chicago,
Of
different it
course.
was all the tough guys and it was a level playing field. I would
Which is
say
the
the more,
beautiful thing about it.
right. And I would say now it's less of a level playing field unless you're cognizant of the fact that the political aspects have an important, I don't know, they have an important, the political people think that the narrative provided by the asset prices is important, I
Right.
would say, right? Does,
Yeah.
and so just be aware of that if you're trading. That's all I'm saying. I'm not a
Chris, do you
tin.
think Congress should trade? Do you think Nancy Pelosi should be allowed to trade?
No, I mean, but I'm a fan for I was just a little guy on the floor that has survived, and those people have an unfair advantage from an information perspective,
I agree.
and it's been that way, and
It's just now out in the daylight. Back in the 90s, they had the advantage. You just didn't know about it. Now we all see it. They have Twitter accounts that track these people's trades. There's a reverse Nancy or a reverse Jim
Yeah.
Cramer ETF. Like, there's all these things now where it's so blatantly obvious that these people have an advantage. It's crazy to me that they're allowed to act, which is when you said to me before we started the recording that the political factor is really what drives market. It's like, well, maybe there is more to this politics thing than we understand. Maybe it has nothing to do with public service. Maybe you get into politics because you want to be able to get this type of information. You
Right. You
want
want to
to
be
get,
right.
you
You
want to
want
influence who gets the contracts, who
the
gets, right,
access. You want the
who
access. You
to
want
get
to be closer.
access.
You're closer to the money. My brother's kid just graduated from Cornell,
Good for him.
and was a is in the political sphere, and he was offered a pretty high paying job for a consulting firm with a lot of former politicians on here in New York, and he turned it down to go to work for the guy running for the mayor of the Levi Strauss heir, who's running for mayor in
That's
San
cool.
Francisco, because he was like, no, the money, he goes, AI is going to replace the consultants and the money's in politics. I was like, well, go kid, there you go kid.
That's, I mean, that is not far off. I can't disagree with that.
But to the people out there, I do think that the idea is that we just need to start understanding that if it's obvious, there's a saying, it's if it's obvious, it's obviously wrong. So if we see it on the screen, just make sure that you understand that other people see it as well. It's not just you, right? Just recognize that we are just one of thousands or tens of thousands of people who see the same trade. So that's why I would encourage you to start to look at places that are less obvious for places to trade.
Operate in the gray a little bit. I love that.
Yeah, right. Like, and Stoudemire would always say, like, look for what's not there. Everybody's always
Interesting.
looking, right? Isn't that interesting? Like, look for what's not there because people are always looking
Love
for
that.
what is there.
I love
And
that.
like, what's missing here? Is it like we're at the highs, but there's no real buyers. Like, that's more important than a big
Right.
seller coming in.
Right. It's the same, similar to the, I think it's Charlie Munger or Warren Buffett. They do the reverse problem solving. You want to get rich, find out how to not stay poor. Figure out the things that, right, you know what I'm saying? So it's like that
Right.
reverse of like of looking at the problem from the opposite angle. It's super powerful. Two
For
more
real.
questions for you, Chris.
Yeah,
We could keep
go.
going, I know, but I can't thank you enough for the time again. When I'm in New York next time, hopefully we can do another one in person. That would be great. Because
Yeah, it'd be super great.
I could tell we could just, I'm just very fascinated at someone who has as much experience as you. Not just for the fun stories, but just because you have the idioms, the little sayings, like you're like, even the ticket, you still have a ticket on your desk. That ticket has to be how old? That's an old ticket, isn't it?
You're not using that
nowadays, right?
No.
So give me your most influential person you've ever met on Wall Street. And then give me the saying that lives in your head rent-free that you've been saying to yourself as a trader forever. We all have one of those things. If you've been trading for a couple of years, you got it. So I know you've got one or two. So most influential person, most influential saying, catchphrase.
I met Stanley Druckenmiller on the floor. I shook his hand when I was very young. I met Jim Rogers, who was very funny. Certainly the Walter Frank, he was chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. I was 20, he was 80 something.
Wow.
And then his son Junior, both of them are dead now, taught me about just how to love it was like a game, right? It was a game, but it was a business. But he taught me that, you know, you needed to be able to come back. I went from there to Victor Sprandio, very smart, really disciplined and incredible execution. Just he'd pick up the phone and I was on the floor. He'd go, buy them till I call you back. After 500 of these bigs, I'd call him back. I said, I bought 500 so far. And he said, did I call you? And I was like, no.
I was like, keep buying.
There were the older gentlemen who worked on the exchange, the stock exchange side, brilliant guys who taught me that. And I just was so young, I don't remember their names, but they would teach me that they would put on a position and wait, and they weren't afraid. To see that in action, to see the person put on huge, huge size in stocks, hundreds and thousands of, and just be standing there while he's buying them. And then be like, okay, let's go to lunch. And I'm like, okay.
It's another level of resiliency. It's another level of balls. It really is, right?
Yeah, they always say that the big money is made by waiting. And I have to agree with that.
Might be a Druckenmiller quote.
Yeah, I would suspect. And of course, there's all these traders who nobody knows. You know, David Stone, I always talk about, had five kids, five dogs, and would have $100,000 days most every day. And you could walk up to him and ask him like, hey, I'm cold. You know, I'm like, what do I do? I'm having a cold streak. And he'd be like, all right, get really small and trade like crazy and get your feel back. Stuff like that where you're
I like that,
just right, like you're real heroes. I mean, he has five kids, five dogs, and you know, and he's trading $100,000 a day, and you're just like, Jesus.
And not in today's money either. This is probably years ago, right? Yeah, $100,000 a couple of years ago, a couple decades
before,
ago. That's
before 9/11, a lot of money. And you know, my age, and or maybe even a little bit younger, Billy Kay was a huge natural gas trader. And that was a wild market, probably still is. But in the ring, he would trade 300 lots and take them into numbers and things like that. And then I would watch him get hit on 300, and the whole ring needed him, and so did he. And he was like, "No, I need them." And in the ring, we usually generally, if somebody needed something really bad, you'd give them
some. You'd give it to them, right?
Right. I mean, it was like a professional courtesy.
Sure.
In that regard. I was riding, that Trade Center had huge elevators, must have held 30 people. Maybe
I heard 40. That. Yeah, 20, 30 people, right.
And so I was in, just three of us, and it was two silver guys in the front, and they were the cowboys. They used to look out the window. The Hunt Brothers guys, the brokers for the Hunt Brothers, used to sit in a limousine out front of the. And when the brokers got out of the limousine, the floor brokers, they just sit in this limousine, and then they come and ride the elevator up. But the guys out looking out the window would see the guys coming,
and they'd start buying.
they'd start buying in
Of
front
course.
of those, right?
Looking out the
And
window while the
so,
guy's in
right?
the limo doing coke with strippers or whatever he's doing, waiting to
Whatever,
come in,
right? But
whatever. They'd
you know,
use
they
it
had
as
to
a
wait till the
cue.
Hunt brothers
That
were
is,
like,
I love that story.
and then the true story. But anyway, I was riding up the elevator with these two silver guys, and one silver guy says to the other guy, and just me in the back, and I'm like young, and these guys are like cowboys, they're like the big league guys. And the
Yeah.
guy goes, "I caught my wife with another guy." And the other guy looks at him and says, "You gonna kill him?" And he said, "No, she slept with him. I told the guy she has to, he has to keep her."
Oh my God,
She,
bro.
and I was just like, true story. I was just like, wow, right? Like that's
A
quite a story.
different level. Just a di like that. But
Different level.
that, I love that attitude. I love that. Well, keep it, move on. Next thing. Like that right there, those two sentences embody so much, I feel like, about being a traitor. You know what
And
I
then,
mean?
yeah, I saw one really old guy with total Greenwich, right? Pinstripe seersucker in the summer coming on the floor and all the exchange brass. The guy had to be like 85 and in good shape, but really, you know, seen his day. And all the exchange brass were right there, like on hanging on his every word. And then, so after he had come, and he was all COMEX, it was all metals guys. And I followed him to the subway, and I got on the subway, and I waited till we got next to him. And I waited. There's a long strip between Brooklyn Bridge in the Manhattan side and 14th Street. It's probably like a 4 minute subway ride with no stops. And so I'm hanging on the bar, and I ask him, I look at him, and I say, "Why'd you do it?" And he goes, "Do what?" And I say, "Why'd you margin the Hunt brothers out?" He says, "Be," and he looks at me, and he goes, "Because we could."
The game can always change the rules. That's what he said.
They,
We can, if we, right? That's what he's basically saying. If we can change the rules, they might be right, but we'll just change the way the game is played
and
and
there
take
are
out the big guy.
those guys who knew the board of directors all ended up buying skyscrapers. They came down before anybody knew and bought put spreads, and they all bought skyscrapers on Broadway.
Wow.
I
And
know,
silver still has never gone that high.
right? And I've not gone back.
Still to this day.
I mean, and but. So the lesson to the people who are just watching is know that they can change the rules. Also, B, don't piss off your risk manager,
Yeah.
right?
Before he
Just
tightens up your constraints,
right. You want to make sure
kicks
you
you
have a
out of the market.
right. Always have a good relationship with your clearing firm. Never fight with them ever. Remember, they can change the margins to whatever they want at any
Whenever they
time,
want, right?
whenever
Whatever.
they want. And they
It's
do.
crazy. Yeah,
And
they
they
still
do.
do. Yeah.
Right.
Chris, this has been amazing. I would love to chat with you for another hour. I'm going to probably bother you for another one in a couple of months. I know you're a busy guy with the Lucci Masterclass and all that stuff, but I speak for my audience, I'm sure, when we say thank you.
Oh, yeah, of
Not
course.
just for
Thank
the
you.
insights, for the time, for everything, man. Like, this is, you know, I hope I did a good job of not asking you the same questions, too many that you had already answered, because I know that could be annoying.
I thought you did a great job with the balance to imbalance aspects
Good.
of and helping your people out there.
And I'd like to dive deeper on that with you. Like, I'm serious. In another conversation, I think we could really do some stuff because market profile is, I know how you trade, but it is not a very well known, or in my opinion, it's not very well taught other than by a couple of guys like you guys in the masterclass.
We
Sub
can
a blow.
get Steve Hawkins.
Can we get Steve Hawkins? Where is he?
Yeah,
Is it
he's in
is he in New York?
Chicago, and so
Oh.
he will gladly come on with me and you to talk. And I mean, that's right from the horse's mouth. He's
I would love that.
smarter than both of us.
Hey, listen, on my side, that's not that difficult. So
Right on my side, right?
that's why I do the podcast. I try to take from all these, you know, guys like yourself as
Oh,
much as
you
I
know
can,
what?
'cause
That's a great idea. That's really smart. That's like you get the like you're essentially creating what we did on the floor.
exactly. That's it. And my goal is, when I got into trading, I started in 2016. I had no guidance. I didn't know who to talk to, what to look for. And now somehow, when I started this podcast called The Day Trading Show, no one had that keyword. And it's blown up for me because it's a great keyword. It's really easy. People search day trading in podcasts all the time. So now I want to build this library of really serious traders. I don't interview the guys in Miami with the Lambos. I don't care what kind of car you drive. I don't even want to know. I want to know about your experience. I want to know your track record. I want to know your mistakes. I want to know the lessons, because that's what we can then put on this podcast to pass down to other people. So,
Right, it's
Chris,
a sense, right? You're archiving the. I mean,
exactly. Archiving
I'm
the
only rip.
lessons.
Right, that's I only am basically telling you what I was told.
Exactly.
So
Nothing is
just
really
passing.
new. You know what I mean? It's revamped in a new way, in the Chris Cady way, but you got it from somebody else. And that's what is the beautiful thing about the giving. And, you know, I'm sure you'd agree with me. Last thing. when people do well in trading, because we know how hard it can be, you really want to help other traders. Like, I don't know if everyone feels this way, but I can tell you do, where it's like, if I can shortcut a couple of dollars and keep them in your pocket, like whether it's that or years of learning, hopefully it's that, but anything we can do to help the younger trader. Cause we both, I'm sure you remember what it was like to be a young trader on the floor and not know nothing. So green, you didn't even know how to spell green.
You know, it's all the things I've learned have been passed down, and then, and so, or painfully learned it. But yes, let's get Steve Hawkins to everybody let's out there. Feel free to, you know, to tune in and ask questions
maybe even we'll do a live one, Chris. Maybe we'll do like a little live Q&A thing where I can get the audience to show up live, and that would be great. That would be sick for the Market Profile stuff. Do some screen share. That'd be cool.
Yep.
Good luck in the Sanglucci Masterclass. I'm going to put your Twitter down below. Do you want me to send anybody anywhere else, Chris? Any other websites you want me to send the listeners to find you?
No, that's it. I have a Twitter presence. I teach at Lucci. And you know, that's all Charlie and Jay and
Ron and everybody. Shout out the boys. Yeah. Shout out the Lucci boys. We love the Lucci boys. Awesome. All right, Chris. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. I can't thank you enough again.
For our listeners, everybody.
Thank you very much. We'll see you guys in the next episode.
All right, bye.